Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi folks, I'm Jelaine Fenner and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today, and I'm here with my co-host,
Tom Azure.
And it's gardening time.
Oh, do you know, Jelaine, we're not supposed, as parents and grandparents, we're not supposed to have favorites, but this is one of my favorite shows.
Oh, yes. Well, that's because Tom is learning to be a farmer, or at least a gardener for sure, and maybe kind of farming. And we have our garden guy, Gary Heilig, who is a master gardener, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about himself. Gary, welcome.
Thank you for having me. And I'm a retired extension agent. I worked for Michigan State University for 34 years as a horticulture educator, and my specialty is fruit and vegetable production.
Okay. And how big is your garden?
Well, that varies from year to year. I guess our garden is about 90 by 50, but we have a blueberry planting, and we have a 70-tree orchard, and we have other areas that can be planted that could be maybe another half acre, three quarters. So we have about 10 acres altogether.
He's serious, huh, Tom?
That's right. And not only that, he has his own YouTube channel.
Oh, that's right. We know. Yes, we'll fill you all in, folks, more about Gary and how you can contact him or watch him on YouTube. Well, Tom, why don't you have a word of prayer with us?
Absolutely. Our Father in heaven, you just have joy. You smile. You let us participate in growing our own food. And Lord, those gardening is one of the top hobbies in America, and because it brings such joy and has such wonderful results. Just be with us today as we start working on our May planting. In Jesus' name, amen.
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 So, Gary, in May, what do we need to do? Because if you've wanted to start some plants, you should have already started them inside.
Right. I have broccoli up already at about 4 inches high.
So. Really?
Yeah, pretty soon I'll be hardening them off before putting them in the garden.
You'll be what?
Hardening them off. They have to transition from the greenhouse to the outdoors.
It's a little harsher, huh?
So what do you do? How do you do that?
Well, what you do is slowly acclimate them to the sunlight, because when you grow something indoors, it has a very thin waxy coating called the cuticle. And if you were to take that and put it directly into the garden from your home or from a greenhouse, it essentially would burn up.
You know, I knew that it would burn up, but I didn't know it was called a cuticle.
Yeah, it's a waxy coating. And also, it takes about 10 days for the plants to get acclimated. And what I usually like to do is just set my plants in the shade and just leave them there for 10 days.
Okay.
So they don't need the sunlight.
Oh, they'll be getting sunlight.
But not direct.
Well, you know, sun is bouncing, the light is bouncing all over the place. So they don't need direct sunlight. They'll be able to be introduced to direct sunlight after about 10 days. The other way you could do it is increase the amount of sunlight, direct sunlight, that the plants get a little bit each day for those 10 days. But that's a lot of moving around.
So if you haven't planted inside to get your garden growing, You're going to go buy the plants, correct? So that you can plant them sometime in May, depending, because we cover from middle of Illinois up to the UP, depending on your growing season.
Well, so are you asking me about buying plants?
Well, that's what? Because if they've not started them inside, that's what they're going to have to do.
It's really kind of late. I mean, there's some things that you can still start inside, like lettuce, things that grow very quickly. But if you were to start a tomato plant or eggplant, an eggplant will take up to 2 weeks just for it to germinate, and by the time you would want to set it outside, which is after your frost-free date, which is around Memorial Day in our area, it's probably only going to be about 3 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes much longer for a 3-inch plant to grow to maturity than it does if you have something that's 6 or 7 inches.
And to get the fruit that we're all looking for.
That's right.
So if you're going to start your garden, plant in May, what should you be planting?
Well, early in May, for instance, when we're talking about mid-May, you can put things out there that can handle a light frost, like cabbage and broccoli and things of that sort. But if you're going to direct seed onions, you want to get those in as soon as you can. Lettuce can be put in that time. Any of the leafy greens can be put in, spinach, and those can be direct seeded, and they can take some cold weather. But you don't want to put warm season crops, the things that will not take cold weather very well, out until we get to about the end of May. Now, if you're down in Illinois, it's going to be a little bit earlier because it warms up down there sooner.
And for our listeners in the UP, what is their
Goodness. Well, what I would suggest people do if you're in different parts of the state is the MSU Extension Office will have a bulletin where you can find out what the last day is, the last frost-free date. And when we talk about a frost-free date, for instance, around Lansing, it's about Memorial Day. That means you only have about a 5% chance of a killing frost. So if you're going to try to push things a little earlier, then you're going to have to be prepared to protect them from the frost. And there are a lot of ways you can do that.
Well, now let me ask you about that. A killing frost, because it can frost, but it might not be a killing frost. Can you tell us a little bit, how do you know if you're having a killing frost?
Basically, a light frost, the cool season crops can handle it with no trouble. And a light frost is where you have ice crystals forming on the surface of the plant. A killing frost is where it gets so cold that the liquid inside the cells actually, and it's called cytoplasm, it actually freezes. And what happens when water freezes?
Turns to ice.
It expands.
Oh, yeah.
And if it expands, if you know anything about the physiology of plants or the anatomy of
the
plants.
The structure,
yeah. The cells are rigid, so they're not like our cells. They basically break
when the water expands. That's kind of like my plumbing pipes this winter, right?
Yeah. And, of course, when they break, the plants had it. So
okay.
That's the difference between a light frost and a killing frost.
And so how long does the temperature need to stay 32 below for this killing frost? Do you have any idea?
Well, that depends on the type of plant you have, too. So if you have something that has a thicker leaf, like a cabbage plant, it'll take longer than it would be for something that has a very thin leaf.
Because that's why they can kind of handle some frost.
Yeah, they can. And actually, anything in the cabbage family, a light frost later in the season will actually improve the flavor of those plants.
Oh, interesting.
But things like zucchini, tomatoes, peppers, they will not take a frost at all.
Okay.
You know, this, I really appreciate this because, you know, all my life we talked about killing frost, but you've just got down to the molecular level, and this is fun.
That's what I do.
Amen.
So you need to design your garden before you get out there. Yeah, I don't know if you need to draw it, or you at least need to have in your head, like, where you're going to plant your plants. And there's a good reason to do this, correct?
Well, but you know what? I want to share something. I've been dreaming about this all winter long. You know, it's been in my head, but we're coming down to crunch time.
Yeah, and, you know, you want to get started because spring comes really fast, and there's so many different things that you need to do. And when it comes to designing a garden, it depends on a number of different things. For instance, I'm going to design my garden a little differently if I have small children and I want to teach them how to garden than I would be if I'm interested strictly in production. For instance, if I'm strictly interested in production, the space in between my rows is going to be very small and plants are going to be really jammed in there.
It could be tight.
Right. Whereas with a child, you want to leave a little bit more space because they're not as stable, especially very small toddlers. And you want them to be able to be in the garden. My grandfather was a person that if I stepped on a plant when in his garden, I was kicked out immediately.
He was kind of brittle, huh?
Yeah, he was rough on me. But anyway, I can understand why, because you get something planted and somebody comes and sits on it, not a good deal.
You know, I really appreciate you, because this is opening up as my grandchildren get older. They're still 1 year old, but so I'm not worried about them in my garden this season, but maybe next season I need to think about it. I want to also run into something else. You know, last year was the first really big year. I've had gardens off and on through the years. But, you know, when you do your garden and you got your plants and whatever, you get to the end of the row, you either have too many or you have too few. Isn't there some improvising that you do on the fly when you're planting that garden?
Not necessarily. I usually plan everything out, and I have way more planted than I'm ever going to use. So I always give some away, and I have enough that I could go to the farmer's market and sell the extra if I want to.
Okay.
But I like to give stuff away. So. But getting back to the planning, for instance, if you have small children, one of the things we used to have is an area right in the center of the garden where we would make a little teepee for the kids and a place to rest, and they could grow whatever they wanted.
I love this.
And we did that for a couple of reasons. One, when they're in the center of the garden, we could keep an eye on them. And two, this was their space. And they had an opportunity to play around. And I would not tell them what to do. I would only give them advice if they asked for it. And so we let them grow anything they wanted there, and that started them on the journey to gardening.
Could I call that the training garden?
Yeah, you could. And there's all kinds of cool ideas that you could use. We could probably do just a whole program just on that. The other thing I like to do is group things that require the same type of care together. So I know I'm going to have to spray things like broccoli and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, and basically the pest problems are the same. So I will group those in one part of the garden so when I have to spray, I can spray that area. I also like to move things around, especially if you've had a garden for a while. Corn and tomatoes, for instance, are heavy feeders. They take a lot of nutrients out of the ground. Whereas lettuce and spinach, they don't take very much. So what I will do is move those things around. One year it might be on the south side of the garden, the heavy feeders. The next year I have light feeders there so that I'm always trying to take the nutrients out of the ground evenly. Another thing that I try to do is some intercropping.
What's and that? Intercropping.
Intercropping is where you put short season crops in between crops that take longer to grow. So, for instance, when I put a tomato plant in, it's not going to start producing till late July going into August. But I can have spinach out of the garden in about a month. So I put spinach and lettuce in between my tomato plants, which are usually about 2 to 3 feet apart, and I can get a crop in that row before the tomatoes shade those short-season crops.
So you plant a tomato plant, and then about 2 feet, you plant the next tomato plant?
Depending on what size tomato. Some tomatoes, for instance, the indeterminate types that get really large, I'll plant those about 3 feet apart. And then I'll put a row of radishes or
in between.
Lettuce or
okay, something that grows a little bit faster.
Right, right.
Okay, that's interesting. That's good to know.
Jelaine, I'm taking notes here.
I know you are.
What about fertilizing? Do we fertilize before we start?
You do, but the first thing you want to do is run a soil test.
And so how do people do soil testing?
Well, the way Michigan State University does it, if you're going to use the university, is you can order a soil testing kit online. You can go to the MSU bookstore, and they send this to you, and they give you all the instructions you need. But basically what you do is—
You're talking about the online, not the campus store, or both?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, if you happen to be close to MSU.
With any of the extensions?
Right.
The local county extensions?
You'd have to check with your local extension office. Some of them will carry the kits and some of them may not.
Now, and there's a cost for the kits, do you know?
Yeah, it's about $25
okay.
now. But a soil test is good for 3 years. So we're talking about roughly $8.30 a year. And that's a pretty good investment because you can save on adding nutrients by taking a soil test.
Just double checking. So can you go online and order this from the bookstore?
Yes, you can.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
okay.
So what you want to do is take these little subsamples, and in a vegetable garden, you want to go down about 6 inches. You can use a hand trowel. Take about 20 different samples from around the garden so that you have a good representative sample. Mix these together in a clean container, and you need to save about a cup of it. And they have a plastic bag, and it's a self-mailer, so if you buy the kit, it will be postage already paid for. So once you send that in, they will send you an email that will give you the information on what your results have. And then there's a website that you can go to where you put your figures in, and it will start to give you recommendations.
What if you need to add lime or I'm married to a farmer. They use a lot of lime.
Well, they do because farmers use a lot of what we call acidifying fertilizers, whereas in a home situation, the amount of fertilizer that you're using isn't likely to drive down the pH of your soil to where you would need lime. Most people do not need lime in Michigan.
Okay.
So that website is michiganstateuniversity.edu/bookstore?
No, just the MSU bookstore.
Okay.
All right.
That's great.
But that's very important. If you want to have a good garden, you need to know the soil, what it is.
Right. You need to know the nutrient level. And they also tell you what your organic matter level is. And we like to have anywhere between 3 and 5% in most vegetable gardens. The exception to that would be if you happen to have a muck soil or what we call an organic soil, which means you have more than 20%. Now, once you get your recommendations back, then what we like to do is put down all of the phosphorus and all of the potassium 10 days before planting and 2/3 of the nitrogen. And then we till that in. That's called broadcasting it over the entire area.
And this is about 10 days before you're actually going to plant your garden.
That's right. And then we put the last third of the nitrogen on about 6 to 8 weeks after the garden has started to grow.
This sounds like a recipe to me.
It's sort of like that, yeah.
Okay, I want to talk about asparagus because I love asparagus.
And I got asparagus, came in the mail, and it's sitting there. I don't know if I'm treating it right. And, it snowed.
I guess you'll find out, won't you?
Yes, I will find out. It snowed, and I didn't know if I should put it. Now, that was when we were recording this a couple weeks in advance.
You could have planted it. It's harder to plant when there's snow in the ground.
Frost in the ground.
If you can work the soil, you can still put it in.
Okay.
I mean, because they have it in coolers anyway before they plant it. And those coolers are down close to freezing, around 34 degrees or so. So putting it in the soil wouldn't have been a problem. But when we grow asparagus, you can grow it from seed, but normally people will grow it from what are called crowns. And you dig a trench about 12 inches deep, put your crowns in, spread the roots out, and then you slightly cover it over with soil. And then as those plants are starting to grow, then you slowly fill in that that trench that you put in, and it takes about maybe 2 or 3 weeks, not more than a month, for you to fill in that trench as
so
the plant's growing.
You said about 12 inches down into your garden, mm-hmm. but then how wide should that trench be?
About the same.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just wide enough so that you can spread out the roots. Yep.
Okay.
So when it emerges, when the green part of it emerges out of the ground, then you start mounding it up
as it's growing.
Wow, I'm glad I listened to the show.
Okay, and then now, doesn't asparagus grow every year?
Yes, it's what we call a perennial vegetable. So the root system survives, and usually in May you start to get these spears coming up, and then we cut them down. But the first 2 or 3 years you don't harvest at all because you want the crown to get established. So about the second or third year you can harvest a little bit of asparagus, but if you take too much, you will end up causing the plant to die out.
So asparagus is something you need to plan ahead of time because you're not going to harvest. You plant it that first year, mm-hmm. you're not going to really harvest it that year.
No. It's going to be about the third year that you can start to harvest some.
You know, I'm just kind of thinking as I've got these asparagus plants that have come in the mail, and I had them over by my wellhead next to my workshop, but it's not in my garden. That's where I saw a couple spears come up in past years. I'm just wondering if I should plant that there rather than into my main garden, because I'm probably going to rotate those crops and moving them around because of the heavy feeders and the light feeders. Am I on the right track?
If you have asparagus in the garden, you just have that spot that you're not going to put anything else.
Kind of like your strawberries.
Right. Yeah. It's a perennial, so it stays right there. You don't move it.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time for this first section. But stay tuned, folks, because we have more with the Garden Guy. We're going to learn more about gardening.
This is JB, host of Joy in the Morning. My friends, would you like to help spread the news of God's true character? Would you like to help spread the news of Jesus' soon return? People are dying for the lack of knowledge of Jesus. And one good way to help spread the news is through Strong Tower Radio. If you would like to help support this ministry, why not go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org. There you'll find two choices. You can have a one-time donation, or you can join my wife and I and hundreds of others in becoming a covenant partner and making a regular monthly donation. May the Lord bless you as you prayerfully consider supporting Strong Tower Radio with your prayers and financial support. Thank you for listening to Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. I'm Jalene Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today and Tom's favorite show about gardening.
That's right. It's the Good Growing with the Garden Guy and Garden Gal. And we have the garden couple with us. We have the garden guy's wife. She's off mic, but we're going to get here on front of this mic one of these days.
Right, because it's Gary Heilig. He is our garden guy. Welcome, Gary.
Happy to be here.
And he always talks about we, when he's talking
about
his garden.
That's right. We need to know who we is.
So maybe in a future show.
Or is it we are? Okay.
Maybe in a future show, you will get to meet Jesusa. That's mm-hmm. correct, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I said it right.
Heilig.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to talk about, we're talking about May and planting our garden. Now, question is, especially if you're a fairly new gardener, or maybe brand new, or you've been doing it for a couple years, but how do you know how much to grow? Because normally we grow way too much.
That depends on what your plans are. It's going to be different if you're just growing it for fresh eating than if you want to do some processing or even sell extra at the farmer's market. And for instance, let's say you like broccoli, which I happen to love. The way I tell people to determine how much they need to plant is based on how often would you eat broccoli during the course of a week.
Okay.
And then...
then increase it 25%.
Well, what you want to do is think about, if I'm just going to eat it fresh, that's different than if I want to have enough broccoli to last me until the following season.
Correct.
And so if, say, for instance, you ate it twice a week and... you think about how many weeks you want to have it, and then you can decide how many plants you're going to need. Now, one year, I don't know, some people might remember when the government gave us money to get the economy going.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of decades ago. Well, we bought a freezer with ours because that year we had planted so much broccoli, we literally filled that freezer with broccoli.
Oh, my.
It was the broccoli freezer, huh?
It was the broccoli freezer. It really was, and we had broccoli all winter long.
Okay.
So it really depends on what you want to do, and you really need to think about what the plants can produce. And again, Extension has bulletins that will tell you in a 50-foot row how many pounds of potatoes or whatever the case may be, how much it'll produce, and that will help you to decide how much you need to grow. But you don't want to plant a whole row of lettuce, because even a vegetarian can't eat that much lettuce.
You'll be feeding it to the cows.
Oh, you'll be feeding it to whatever will take it.
And you can't preserve lettuce very well.
No, you can't.
And the other thing is, we talked a little bit as we prepare for the show, is you can do it not only for yourself, but you can be generous, or you can go to the farm market.
Well, I'm an elder in our church, and one of the things we do is visit. And what I would do sometimes is I would take some produce that was coming out of our garden. And one time I visited a lady, and I had some fresh raspberries that I had just picked. I couldn't believe the reaction that I got from that person just because I gave her some raspberries. So when somebody grows something in their garden and they take it to a neighbor,
it's a personal gift.
Yeah, it is.
And greatly appreciated.
Yes, they
especially
do
if it's a shut-in or somebody who doesn't have access and maybe on a tight budget.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's very true. Okay, let's talk about some fruits. Now, let's talk about growing melons, because you have to be careful with the frost with them, right?
Yeah, they are a warm season crop. But the reason I put this on our outline is because most people just put them in the ground. But if you want to double your production on growing melons, then either put down a landscape fabric or black plastic.
Okay.
And then plant the melons on that. And melons really like warm soils. And if you use a black plastic or a landscape fabric when you're getting them started, they will do much better and they will produce a lot more melons.
Okay. I want to go back to, because you talked about, you know, Michigan State, the extension. So most people first, they might want to check with their county extension what information they can get,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. And then if they need to go online, where are they going to just type in Michigan Extension to...
There is a website called Gardening in Michigan, which is through Michigan State University, and it has all types of home gardening information. And plus the fact you can Google Michigan State's website in general, and you can go through the different pages and find horticultural information.
Okay. Right. Yeah. If you don't know something, you'll Google it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You can also call the local extension office, and they usually should be able to tell you where to go.
And, you know, across the country, there's extension services, and certain colleges are hooked into that. I know that in Minnesota, they have a great mm-hmm. extension sites, and I believe Iowa and...
Cornell, Purdue. Mm-hmm. Every state has a land-grant college.
And those Michigan State happens to be ours.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so talking about fruits, like, if you like strawberries, you probably should have a strawberry patch.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things. And strawberries right now are starting to grow down where I live. Now, it's a little slower up here, but my strawberries are already about 1.5 to 2 inches high.
Wow.
Which also makes them very susceptible to frost.
Right.
So one of the things I do, especially when they're flowering, is I will have a lawn sprinkler out in my vegetable garden. And if the temperatures are starting to drop down below freezing and I have flowers, and the biggest strawberries are usually the first flowers that come out, I will turn on the sprinkler at night and essentially coat those plants with ice.
Do you just need it till they coat and put it on a timer, or do you need to run it all night?
It needs
long?
To be run all night. Okay, the commercial growers, what they will do is they'll run the irrigation all night. By coating the plants, you hold the flowers at 32 degrees, and they will do just fine. And when the sun comes up in the morning and they're starting to melt, that's when you turn the water off. That's okay in a situation where you have a lighter textured soil, but if you have a soil where water stands, like a heavy clay soil, that could cause some root rot issues for your strawberries.
Okay. So
I'm going to go out and check my garden to see if those strawberries are up, starting to emerge.
They're probably starting to, and if you took care of them properly, there should still be straw on them. And you pull the straw back.
Oh, he didn't put straw. Well, he put straw over.
The reason the straw is on them is, especially if you have a higher clay content, when the soil's wet, when it freezes, it expands, and the soil contracts when it melts. The roots, 90% of the roots of strawberries are in the top 6 inches of the soil, and that expanding and contraction of the soil will break the roots and weaken the plants when they start to grow in the spring. So when you put the straw over top of it, you cut down on that freezing and thawing cycle, and that will help to protect the plants. And that should have been put on in November.
In the fall. And, you know, I just talked to the farmer who farms my land this morning, and I asked the farmer's wife, I did that for Jelaine, I asked the farmer's wife if not only can he pay me in cash, but also to deliver, I asked for 6 bales of hay. He's probably going to give me a half of one of those round things, bales or something like that. But
you won't be able to even move that.
Okay, that's true. I maybe a quarter, a hail, I don't know, a bale or something.
Those things are heavy.
I'm learning.
But so mention that in the fall, though, is when you're going to cover up with the straw these plants that are going to lay dormant and then come back next year.
Right. Basically, you don't put them on until we've had such cold weather that the leaves are no longer standing up. They're flat to the ground. That's when you put the straw on.
Okay. So let's talk about if you want to plant fruit trees. How do you decide what fruit trees, other than what you like to eat, how do you decide that this is good for your ground?
Well, before we leave the strawberry patch.
Okay.
Our listeners in the UP, you talked about Lansing, the growing environment there. Mm-hmm. We only alluded to our Illinois, Central Illinois listeners. But what about those UP? I mean, in the UP, there's some people go up there and do strawberry gardens, and there are some awesome strawberries that come out of the UP.
Mm-hmm.
So where are we at?
Everything's
them?
Just later. They may still have snow up there.
Just add time.
Yeah, it's just a little bit different. Usually the strawberries start to break dormancy when you start getting in the mid-40s.
Okay.
So whenever that happens up there, what I usually tell people is when it starts to warm up, go out, pull the straw back, and see if you're seeing new growth. And if you're seeing new growth, then you can pull it back. If you're going to have a freeze, you can push it back to give a little protection. But usually when you start getting in the 50s and 60s, things really start to grow.
Okay. So let's talk about fruit trees. How do you decide what fruit trees you want, other than what you know, peaches, apples you want? But does it matter how the soil is, what fruit trees you plant?
You do need well-drained soils in order to grow fruit trees. Now, pears and apples are much more tolerant of wetter soils, but cherries, peaches, nectarines, plums, apricots, they don't take it very well. As a matter of fact, if there's standing water around a cherry tree, it's just going to die.
Okay.
So that's one thing. Another thing is space. How much space do you have? Because if you want to grow a peach tree, for instance, it's self-fruitful, which means you don't have to have another tree for cross-pollination. So you can plant one peach tree and get peaches, whereas with apples, the majority of them require cross-pollination, so you'll need at least two.
Is there a male and female tree?
No, it's not that. They do have what we call perfect flowers on them, which means they have all the floral parts.
Okay.
Whereas some trees just have female parts and others have male parts. But you have to have cross-pollination in order to get fruit production. Like with a red delicious apple, if you don't have a golden delicious or something else is blooming at the same time, you'll just have a few apples because bees can visit that tree and get the nectar without getting into the pollen very much. So you won't get much pollination. But if they go to another tree, then they get the pollen on their bodies, and then when they come to the red delicious tree, that pollen is transferred.
You know, I was blaming this one tree, apple tree, old one in the middle of my yard, and I thought it was because of unfruitful tree. Is it possible that I didn't have another apple tree within a given distance of it?
Highly unlikely, because the bees can travel miles.
Okay.
And so that's usually not it. And plus the fact there's certain crab apples like Dolgo crab, which is spelled D-O-L-G-O. It can also act as a pollinator for our edible apples. So rarely is a lack of a pollinator a problem unless you are really far away from people. And I'm talking miles.
Okay,
so you're going to select trees. How do you, you know, where you're going to go buy a tree.
Mm-hmm.
How big should it be? How do you know that that's a healthy tree you're buying that you're going to plant?
Well, you have two options. You can either go to catalog companies or you can go to your local garden centers. Now, the garden centers usually have what we call semi-dwarfs, which means they're a little smaller than standard trees, but not as small as you can get. You'd have to go to some commercial companies for the smallest trees. But when you're getting one, you want the largest tree that you can start with, because most of the time in the nurseries, they've already started the training process for you. So that's a positive thing. Also, by having an older tree when you buy it, then it comes into production much sooner. So now the very dwarf trees are quite precocious, which means they come into production within just a couple of years, depending on what type of a training system you use.
So if you've just planted a fruit tree, like let's say last year, 2018 was last year, we planted a fruit tree. Did it produce fruit, or it's gonna, or we don't pick it, we wait a year?
Well, if you bought a tree that's maybe 3 or 4 years old, it is capable of producing fruit, but the first thing you want to do is develop the framework. And when you allow a tree to produce fruit when it should be trained, then that plant is not going to grow as fast vegetatively. So on my YouTube channel, I have a series of videos. I think I have 3 or 4 now on training a new fruit tree. And this one happens to be an apricot. So I have, what do you do the first year? What do you do the second year? What do you do the third year? So I did the third year one just recently. So that gives you an idea. But of that tree, last year was going to produce a couple of apricots and they fell off. This year, it would have produced some, but we had below zero temperatures. Mm-hmm. And I'm waiting to see if the apple or the flowers have been fried. Which I'm betting they have been.
Okay. So when it comes to fruit trees, this isn't something, it's not like you're going to plant the lettuce and you get lettuce.
No, it's a little bit more time investment.
Okay.
And you know, it's interesting. Gary mentioned his YouTube channel, and we could give that address.
Let's do that right now. So Gary, tell us how people can look up on YouTube. They go to YouTube and they're going to type in your name?
Yeah, just Gary Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G, and that will take you to my channel.
Okay. Now,
and you know, the other thing to think about too is I was listening to Audioverse and they have Ad Agora, and that's on Audioverse, just as it says, one word, and download it. They have a program with Greg Johnson, I believe is the name. He's been doing trees for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And the information he had on that one program just in an hour just blew me away. Uh-huh. So I would encourage you to go to Gary's channel, but also look up this on Audioverse. I believe his name is Greg Johnson.
So they're going to type in Orchards. Audioverse and find their website. And then
look for Orchards and Greg Johnson.
You can just type in the name of the person, the speaker, and his stuff will come.
Okay. So both of these resources, I listened to it and I was blessed. And I'm going to go to Gary's now that we're going to do trees.
Yeah. Okay. So you have trees. You need to spray them in the spring?
Yeah. If you want good quality fruit, you're going to have to spray. Now, how much you spray depends on what you want to do. For instance, if I was growing apples primarily for processing, I can spray less than if I was growing apples to take to a farmer's market, because cosmetics is everything when you're trying to sell something. And the majority of pesticides that are applied to many fruits are for cosmetic reasons. Not all, but, you know.
So how do you determine then what kind of spray? Because people are trying to stay away from chemicals.
Well, first of all, you're going to spray something, whether you're organic or more conventional. People think that organic fruits and vegetables don't have sprays on them, but they do. They're just different sprays.
You wouldn't want to have the fruit if it didn't have a spray on it.
Well, in some cases, like with apples, it probably wouldn't be very edible unless you didn't mind eating maggots.
You put that so succinctly.
That's what happens. But of all the fruit trees that you can grow, the one that would require the least sprays and still get a usable crop would be pears.
Oh, okay. All right.
But most of the others, like cherries, unless you spray them, you're going to have maggots in them. And I remember a time that I was over the sponsor for our softball team, and he had a cherry tree, and he was just munching on them. And I said, yo, Tom, do you spray those cherries? And he said, no, why? And I picked a series of cherries and opened them up, and just about every one of them had maggots in them. But it didn't bother him was what really got me. He just kept eating the cherries.
You've ruined my appetite at the moment.
Preference. Yeah. You know, I could really ruin your appetite.
Okay, no, let's not talk about things like that. Okay, what about blueberries? Because blueberries, same thing like strawberries, perennial.
Mm-hmm. It's a perennial bush. Very nice ornamental to have because blueberries in the fall look sort of like euonymus. It turns bright red. Mm-hmm. And in the spring, they have these little bell-shaped flowers that are very beautiful. And most of the time, you'll see various types of bees, like bumblebees, on them, pruning them, or not
pollinating.
I wish I could have bumblebees prune my blueberries. But anyway, they will be pollinating, and they have beautiful blue fruits, and you can eat those fresh, or you can dry them, because dry blueberries are delicious.
Okay. Amen. So is there much care to the blueberry bushes?
Blueberries are kind of easy to grow if you have the right soil conditions, because they like acidic soils. Fairly low pH, around 4.5 to 5.2. But you don't prune them for about the first 3 or 4 years after you plant them, so you don't have to worry about that. If you can prune a lilac, you can prune a blueberry. It's just a matter of pruning out the really old stuff to encourage new canes to come up. And they do have to be sprayed, but they don't have as many pest problems as, say, apples do. And so you can have blueberries without as much work as you would have to have for some other tree fruits.
So we're going to run out of time, but we're going to start talking about if you want a perennial flower garden.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to do to get that started?
Well, you need to plant a perennial flower garden. For instance, if it's up against the house, you're going to want to put your plants, the largest plants in the back, and then move down to the lower plants. And depending on how much space you have, there is a rule of thumb how far the plants drop in terms of their appearance. And if it's an island bed, like in the middle of the yard, then your tallest plants will be in the middle. But what you want to do is think about, do I want this to peak in the spring or the summer or the fall? And that will determine what type of plants you choose. And also, another thing you'll want to do is select plants that have different textures.
What do you mean by textures?
Some will have smooth leaves, some will have wide leaves, thin leaves, rough leaves. When you have different textures there, it makes the garden look more interesting.
Mm.
And so there are all kinds of references that will help you to decide how to lay out a perennial garden. You want to decide on the color scheme because you can have an all-white garden, which people like to look at night, full moon, or you can have one that uses the color wheel where you're using opposite colors, like purple goes with yellow and those types of things. Or you can do something that is called an analogous garden where you're using colors that are close to each other on the color wheel.
Okay.
And you can look up color wheels also on the internet.
You know, these are wonderful suggestions, but there's no garden police, as my sister says. It's preference, preference, preference.
Yeah.
What you like.
I mean, just the whole idea of how we lay out a vegetable garden, for instance. Rows were established for machinery and for
production.
Ease. But there's a Japanese style of gardening where they just throw all the seeds together and let everything grow.
And then you have the English garden.
Oh, yeah, a very formal type garden. So there are many different options, and I encourage people to play around. There's nothing that says you have to plant things in rows. If you want little circles, little squares, whatever you want.
And just in summary and tying this up, You may want to have different gardens throughout your yard. You could have your formal in one section. You can have your Japanese. You can have each type. Your production garden is what you want to grow from. And all gardens do not be plants. They don't have to be all flowers.
Yeah.
I mean, all vegetables or flowers.
When I first started, I was only interested in food crops. But as we developed, my wife and I gardened together, and we incorporated flowers. Then butterflies started coming in, hummingbirds, and there's just all kinds of cool stuff that you can see.
So when we come back, we're going to talk about turf.
That's right. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner with Strong Tower Radio today with our favorite program that my co-host,
Tom Majeure,
loves. It's The Gardening Guy with Gary Heilig.
And we added a bonus here. You know, we've got Jesusa, which is his wife, and I kind of think of them as Adam and Eve here. Jesusa, okay. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
She has been sitting back in our program, and we've talked about her already a little bit, that because he always talks about, you know,
we
when we talk about his gardening. And so we've invited Jesusa to join us in our this last segment. When we stopped, we stopped, the last segment was, I was asking about the perennial flower garden, which I bet, Jesusa, you really like, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, my perennial garden has been suffering over the past couple of years because we're kind of in a wet area. So I've been searching for plants that like wet feet.
Okay. So you have your plants, you have to deal with your environment and soils.
That's right.
And your shades.
And rather than amend the garden, we're looking for plants that are suited to where we want to plant them.
So that's a question I have about flowers, because I have a little flower garden. And they always say you need lots of sun for any gardening, whether in flowers, but I don't have a lot of sun. So how, like, you're looking for something that is, they'll take the water because it's wet. I need something that can grow, you know, more in shade than, you know, the full sunlight. So how do you find that?
Well, I like to read Better Homes and Garden, and they have gardens that will say they're a shade garden or they're a sun garden. And I do find different things that I never even thought of growing. And then, of course, my husband is a horticulturist, so I just kind of pick his brain a little bit, too, to find out what things like wet feet. And we found a few things, and I'm going to continue, but I really want to grow peonies, and peonies just don't like wet feet. So I'm going to have to figure something out for that.
You know, I also look at different magazines, and I like to go to the bookstore and peruse the garden books, and you'll see plants there that aren't normally found in most garden centers. So then I get on the internet, which is one of the best things that ever happened to the world. And if you're looking for a particular plant, you can usually find it a lot easier than you used to be able to.
You know, and Jesusa, she's a master gardener.
Yes, also a dance master gardener.
Master gardener. And Gary, and they're a team. In fact, I like the fact that they said that they've been married 44 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But you've known each other longer than that. How much longer?
Well, since before kindergarten.
So this is a lifelong friendship.
Lifelong.
Yeah. We went to elementary school together, middle school together. We called it junior high then. High school, we started college together. She finished at Michigan. I transferred to Michigan State.
And these guys, they almost finish the sentence for each other, I've noticed, too. So praise the Lord.
That's what happens when you get older.
Well, and you've been together a long time.
And it's a sign of a good relationship.
Yeah. Okay, so everybody usually thinks about, when you're thinking of flowers in the spring, tulips. Now, and they only come up in the spring, right? Because you had talked about, Gary.
No, not really.
No, they come up.
No, they come up naturally in the spring, okay. But you can put them in pots and expose them to about 40 degrees for about 14 weeks, and you can make them come up anytime you want.
Really?
Yeah, that's called a forced bulb. People are familiar with that with an amaryllis, where you plant the amaryllis and force it. Ah. So you can do the same. That's what they do. My daughter just gave me a huge, for my birthday in March, about 6 tall purple tulips, and they're grown in a pot, and they were probably grown in January. I don't know, sometime. Okay. So, yeah.
But if you're going to plant them outside, they come up in the spring.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Okay, so my quick side, tulips are beautiful, but then they're done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how do you plant other flowers around?
How to keep that garden beautiful all summer long?
Well, there's going to be a transition period because, say, if you had other perennials coming up in that garden, we usually tell people leave the tulips there until the tops start to die. Once the tops die down, they produce all the sugars for that bulb for that season, and then that bulb will run off of those sugars for the rest of the season.
You know, it's kind of hard to leave those stems, those bare stems up there for a while because you had this beautiful flower and you're looking at these. I've did that, but it's kind of hard to do.
You can cut the stem for the flower, but leave the leaves there until they start to die.
Okay.
So you've got this flower, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. Here's the stem, the flower's up here. So, you know, how low do you cut to where the leaves come off of the stem?
Right, just cut off the stems so that you don't see the main part of the stem, but the leaves are producing sugars that are being shipped down to the bulb.
Oh, okay.
So you don't want to cut those down, otherwise you will weaken the bulb every year until it'll die.
Now, is that till it gets kind of white and yellow? And
when they start to turn yellow, yeah.
Okay. Great. And you want to put other plants right next to them. You can have, even within the tulips, you can go with early tulips and late tulips. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have a succession for a period of time.
Yeah, you can do that. And if you want to mix other things, you can put annuals there once the tulips are gone. Perennials, you have to be a little bit more careful because you don't want to damage your tulips when you're putting them in there. And perennials, eventually you're going to have to divide them. So
you have to dig them up anyway.
Yeah.
So that's something we're going to talk about in the fall, because that's a real important thing. I know I got these daisies, and oh my goodness, they're just flourishing, and I'm thinking I needed to do something because they're just way too many. They're just bunched together enough.
Well, they will naturalize, many of them, if you don't do anything, and as long as they're growing well and they look good, you can leave them alone.
Okay, because they spread. Yeah. I mean, perennial flowers spread.
Yeah, they do. Now, and they get to the point, some perennials, after a certain point, they start to die in the center, and that's the time that you have to divide them. But as long as they're looking okay and they haven't gone beyond the area that you want them in, you're fine.
Now, you probably, even that same garden with your tulips, you may want to put those early winter things. What are those, crocuses?
Crocuses come up usually very early in the spring. They're one of the first things to come up.
They'll come up. Well, you'll see them through the snow.
Oh, yeah. They will come up through the snow. Those are planted in the fall just like all the other bulb plants.
But you can put that in that same garden so you have a succession.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about turf.
We want to be of equal time to all gardeners, so we're going to give the turf people something.
Well, everybody usually likes a nice-looking lawn. What about crabgrass, though? How do you... Because people don't like crabgrass.
Well, I think that Gary is squirming in his chair over there. I think he says, do you need a lawn? Or
Well, a lawn is more of a status symbol more than anything else. If you remember looking
especially
at some of
the... Especially if you're in the Southwest, right?
Yeah, some of the shows on PBS, you look at those big estates that have the very big lawns, and those are pretty much a status. But a lawn nowadays also does some other things. For instance, a typical lawn of, say, 5,000-10,000 square feet will produce enough oxygen for a family of four for a day. And usually where there are lawns around a building, it's cooler in that area than if you had cement around there. So there are some practical uses also.
But, okay, so what about crabgrass?
Crabgrass, I mentioned that because it's the first weed to start growing from seed. And we normally have crabgrass seeds starting to germinate about the time that forsythia is in full bloom. That's that plant yellow. That produces yellow flowers and no leaves, or when the soil temperature reaches about 50 degrees. So what I tell people, first of all, if you want to avoid having to treat for crabgrass, then you should do all the cultural things to get a nice thick lawn, because crabgrass likes to grow in open areas, and when sun can get down to the ground, then you're going to have the crabgrass come in. But if you have a nice thick lawn, then you won't have much trouble with crabgrass. But if you're going to treat it, usually what you use is a material that has something called pendimethalin in it. But the organic option would be corn gluten meal. And there's There's a product called Concern that you can buy. That's a preparation that's in a prilled form, which makes it easier to apply. Or you could go down to a farm elevator and get corn gluten meal, 60% protein content, which is a finer material, a little more fine than cornmeal. And you can apply that at about 2 pounds per thousand square feet, and it will prevent crabgrass from germinating.
Mm, okay.
Now, you said pearl. Is that like a round balls?
Prilled.
Oh, prilled.
It's, yeah, like a little round ball.
Okay.
So,
it's easier to apply.
Does it make a difference what kind of grass? I mean, you know, they talk about all these different brands, or not brands, but names of grass, Kentucky bluegrass, you know.
Yeah.
Does it matter? Is it in your area? It could matter if what kind of grass you should be growing?
That's a yes and no question. The majority of lawns in Michigan are either a mixture of perennial rye, Kentucky bluegrass, and fescues. That's called a mixture. And then if you had a sod, that's called a blend, which is usually all Kentucky bluegrass, multiple species of Kentucky bluegrass. A type of grass that you would not want to grow here is something that is advertised right now in the Sunday Circular. It's called Zoysia grass.
Mm.
And as I was coming up here, I saw a Zoysia lawn. And they're easy to identify because they're totally straw-colored this time of year, even though our cool-season grasses are somewhat green. So Zoysia grass is what we call transition grass between the cool season and the warm season areas. Like down in Florida, they have St. Augustine, Baha'i grass, and those types of things. Those will not grow so well up here.
And you really don't, I really don't like those. They're coarse.
They're more coarse. Bermuda grass is not coarse.
Okay.
It will grow here, but it will look better where it's warm. So the Zoysia grass will look nice and green when it's really hot and dry, but most of the year where it's kind of cool, it's going to be some patchy green, and it doesn't stay where you plant it, so your neighbors aren't going to appreciate it.
I noticed in southern Ohio that there was a company that pushed that big.
Down there is okay. Southern Ohio would be fine.
So is there a proper way to mow your lawn?
There is, and the first thing I would always tell people is be sure you have sharp blades. If your blades aren't sharp, you tend to tear the grass, and it tends to take on kind of a tan appearance to it. And so your blade should be changed at least twice a year. If you hit a lot of rocks, maybe a little bit more often.
Or you have a lot of sand and you bring that up. It stirs that up.
Yeah. Up in the north, it's harder to grow lawns anyway because the soils tend to be more sandy. Also, we generally suggest people keep their mower height at least 3 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And just leave it there all the time, because then your grass will get thicker, and that helps you in the problem with crabgrass.
And drought season, too.
Yeah, grasses that are longer can handle drought a little bit better. And also, if you have a grub problem, if your grass is longer, it takes more grubs per square foot for you to see damage than you would if it's smaller or shorter grass, because it just can't put up with the feeding.
In the spring, I used to put it kind of low so I didn't have to mow it quite so often.
Well, that's usually why they kind of
bad,
lower.
Bad advice.
Well, people like the look also. But when you look at a grass that's cut at 3 inches, it will look the same from the road. You'll only notice it when you're walking through it.
When we moved into our home, we had a weed lawn.
Okay.
So it was just pure plantain and who knows what else. So
I know what else.
So when Gary took it upon himself to work patch by patch, our house sits on the front 3.5 acres, so he mows about 3 acres of lawn. So we went through and he went through and he totally killed out and then replanted. So now we have areas of very beautiful lawn, not in the backyard. Oh, yeah, he did do the backyard too.
Yeah.
So now our lawn looks much better and like real grass and not just a big weed patch, which is what it was before.
But so. I call that a diverse community of plants.
That's politically correct.
But the thing is, I'm not politically correct. You can believe that. But anyway, you have to understand something. A lawn that's just grass is not very useful in the environment, because they're in the beginning of the season when the bees are just coming out, one of their primary sources of food is dandelion pollen. So I don't want all the weeds gone for my lawn because I have an orchard and I want pollinators in the area. And I like to see violets and things, but it's when they get out of control is when I tend to start knocking some of that stuff back.
What about these people who mow their lawn one direction and then the next time they do it the opposite direction? And does direction mean anything, or is that just aesthetics?
Yeah, if you always mow in the same direction, you'll tend to get ruts. If you want your lawn to look like a baseball field, that's what they do, because if you go, say, north to south, the turf will look a certain way. If you come back the next direction, it'll be a darker patch. One will be light and one will be dark. So we suggest you don't always mow the same way. Sometimes I'll mow in circles. I'll start in the middle and keep going out. Sometimes I really get crazy and I just wave all the way through the yard.
I've never thought of that.
He has fun on the mower. That's his go-kart.
Now, but with that is what type of mower do you need?
It depends on how large your yard is. When we first got our house, we bought a push mower. We burned it out the first year. So, for instance, like Jess said, I mow about 3 acres. So we have a lawn tractor, which I absolutely love.
And what size of lawn tractor?
It's 48-inch deck. And I want to move up, but they cost almost as much as a car.
Yeah. So are they mid-size? There's the little garden tractors, then there's that mid-size, and then there's the tractor.
Yeah, they have some nice tractors. I'd like to have one that has about a 60-inch deck, but I'm going to wait till we pay off the house for
that. Okay, I heard you say something about grubs. Mm-hmm. So what do you do if you have lots of grubs in your lawn?
Well, the reason I put that on there is because a lot of times lawn care companies will tell you we need to treat for grubs. And I used to tell people—
Is that a marketing plan?
It is, but what I tell people is before you let somebody spray for grubs, go out there and check to see if you have grubs. And the time to do that is actually in July, because that's when the new ones are hatching out. Now, this time of the year, the grubs from last year are still there. And the reason I mention that is because the materials that you would use on your lawn are different when they're first coming out than when they are in the spring. In the spring, you use either Dilox or 7 granular, but when they're first coming out, you can use imidacloprid or what we call Merit. So you need to know the difference, because I've seen people go to the garden centers and they've had people tell them, this is what you need for grubs, and it was the wrong thing for the wrong time of the year.
Okay, what about moles? And we got hurry up quickly, because we're going to run out of time.
Moles, it takes too much time.
Moles,
but what do you want to know about moles?
Well, they leave all these piles. What do you do about them?
Well, you can ignore them and just roll the lawn. Moles are nature's little plows, and they do a lot of good for trees and shrubs because they allow air to get down to the root system. Okay. They can be a real pain in the neck for somebody that wants that perfect lawn.
Yeah.
There are many ways to dispatch them, and that's a whole program.
All right.
But the thing is, I've gotten to the point where I just leave them alone.
Okay.
That's heresy.
I've gotten soft in my old years, and I think, is the damage that bad? No, it's really not. So,
they leave these piles of dirt all over.
Well, if you can't stand it, the best way to deal with it is trapping, but it would probably take me a good 10 minutes to explain how to trap properly, so we might want to do that in the next
program. Well, we heard that. You heard it here on the Good Growing Show with the Garden Guy.
Well, I used to trap them, and then I said, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life, and I don't like to see dead moles. Yeah. So I've really gotten soft in my old age.
Well, folks, I'm sure glad that you joined us, and tune in next time. Our host, Jelaine Fenner, and Tom Majeure with Gary Heilig, and Jesusa, our new garden assistant or garden wife.
Bye, folks.